why not just go with me? Or at least tell me when I've visited. Control your tongue, Isolde.
Gretcha flashed her an intolerant look.
You may not realize it, but it took me years of planning to get you out. I had to find you lodging in Venyatsa City. I had to find you a job, and I had to do it all without Korlant noticing. So when Alma and I decided to leave as well, it took years more to plan. We would have come for you, Isolde. In Venyatsa City. Why did you leave? She demanded.
I got in trouble.
Isolde sensed the stammer, ready to pounce, so she chomped into her apple to hide it.
The settlement was the only place I could think to hide.
You should have stayed in the city like I told you to. I ordered you never to return.
You ordered that 3 years ago,
Isolde countered.
Forgive me if I tangled your careful weave.
Her mother's bandaging grew rougher, tenser. But there was no pain, and thankfully there was no more reference to her stutter.
We will go to Saldonica now,
Gretcha said at last.
You can come with us.
Isolde's eyebrows shot up. Saldonica was at the opposite end of the Jadansi Sea, a wild city-state seething with illegal trade and crime of every imaginable sort.
But why there?
Alma cleared her throat and angled away from her vigil beside the branches.
I have aunts and cousins that live in the Sermayan Mountains. Their tribe travels to Saldonica each year.
In the meantime, Gretcha added, we will sell threadstones. Apparently there is a growing market for them in Saldonica.
Pirates need love, too.
Alma's lips fell into that easy smile of hers, and she glanced at Gretcha as if this was a shared joke between them. And the brewing ache in Isolde's throat grew larger. She could barely swallow the apple. Gretcha closed her healer kit.
We have enough money saved for a third ticket to Saldonica, Isolde. We planned to invite you.
Isolde found that hard to believe.
Yet she had no idea what her mother or Alma felt right now.
No idea what colors shimmered in their threads or what emotions held sway.
It didn't matter anyway, though. For Isolde had plans of her own. A life of her own to build with Safi.
I can't go with you, Isolde said.
If not with us, then where?
Gretcha pushed to her feet. Matter-of-fact and almost relieved. This was what she had wanted all along. A daughter like Alma. A true thread witch.
Safi's waiting for me nearby.
But she isn't,
Alma blurted. And with her hand outstretched, she hurried toward Isolde. On her palm was a glowing ruby. The second threadstone.
Isolde choked and dropped the apple.
She wrenched out her own threadstone. It also shone with a red light.
Safi was in trouble.
Isolde jumped to her feet. The painstone fell from her lap. Agony crashed over her. First it was pain in a great downward rush, then exhaustion that turned her body to limp straw. She staggered forward into Gretcha's arms. Yet before she could tumble too far, before she could fall onto her mother's shoulder and faint, Alma swooped the necklace off the earth and draped it over Isolde's neck.
Instant relief. Shocking, terrifying relief.
And as Isolde withdrew from her mother, Gretcha turned to Alma.
Can you sense Safi's location?
Alma nodded, her grip on the stone turning white-knuckled. Then she pointed southeast.
That way.
But she's moving north fast. She must be in great danger.
We'll go,
Gretcha declared, moving toward the bay mare.
We have two cutlasses and the bow.
No!
Isolde straightened to her full height. A breeze surged into the willow, shaking branches and pulling at her cut hair.
Somehow, With that burst of cool, fresh wind, Isolde finally regained control of her tongue, of her heart.
Please do as you had planned and travel to Saldonica.
Isolde's fingers wrapped around the pain stone, ready to return it.
Keep it.
Gretcha laid a hand on Isolde's wrist.
You'll never make it to Safia otherwise.
And take Alici,
Alma said, motioning to the grey mare.
She knows the terrain. The brindle will be fine.
The brindle won't be fine, Gretcha snapped, and Isolde flinched.
There was actual emotion in her mother's voice.
Alici is rested and knows the trail. So you will take her, the pain stone, and some money. A cutlass, too.
Gretcha tugged Isolde toward the mare.
Or would you rather have a bow? You can also take the shield. I'll be fine. How do I know that?
Gretcha rounded back on Isolde, her eyes hard.
I never knew if I would see you again. Do you think it was easy for me to let you go? Do you think it is easy now? I loved you too much to keep you in those walls.
Her mother drew closer, her words urgent and fast.
You will take Alici and you will go to Safia's rescue as you always do. You will leave me again because you were meant for bigger things than I can give. And as always, I will pray to the Moon Mother for your safety.
She pushed the reins into Isolde's left palm, but Isolde found her fingers had stopped working. Her voice, too. For there was a hole, deep and exposed, where her heart had just been.
Here.
Alma appeared beside Isolde and offered her a cutlass, the kind used to hack through grass and undergrowth, in a simple scabbard on a worn belt. But Isolde could not reply. She was still felled by her mother's words. Alma wound the belt around Isolde's hips and hung the second threadstone over Isolde's neck, two bright red lights throbbing over a dull pink.
Then she gripped Isolde's left bicep. My family's tribe is called Corelli, Alma said. They come to Saldonica in late autumn. Ask for them, if you ever come. I hope you do.
Isolde didn't answer, and she had no time to wallow in her confusion, for in moments she was seated forward against the mare's neck, her cutlass set back and out of the way.
Find me again,
Gretcha said.
Please, Isolde, there is so much I haven't told you about. Everything. Find me again one day. I will,
Isolde murmured. Then without another word or another glance, she dug her heels into Alici's sides, and she and the mare set off after Safi. Isolde and Alici found the road easily enough. As Alma had promised, Alici knew the route and her canter was sure. Scruffs chased after her for several minutes, but he soon gave up. Isolde's heart clenched with each step that the hound lagged, and she couldn't keep from waving when he finally shambled to a stop. After a quarter hour, the silver meadows ahead shifted into moonlit marshes and sandbars. The breeze began to smell of salt and sulfur. Then a wide dirt road appeared before her. Yet rather than kick the mare into full speed, Isolde pulled the horse to a stop. She was just north of the weedy crossroads at which she'd met the silver-haired monk, a woman as different from that blood witch as the ether was from the void. Then the mare's ears twisted south. Alici sensed company. Isolde swung her gaze down the road to where a horse and rider approached at full gallop. Isolde could see the unmistakable halo of Safi's blonde hair. She could also see the unmistakable white cloaks of four mercenary Carowinds less than a quarter mile behind.
What the hell flames had Safi gotten into?
And how the hell flames was Isolde going to get them out? Isolde closed her eyes, gave herself three inhales to find that place she could never hang on to when her mother or Alma were around, Alici shifted uneasily, clearly ready to get away from whatever was coming, and Isolde was inclined to agree. The horses couldn't gallop forever, and Isolde was pretty sure that 4 Carowind monks would be hard to stop without some defense. A defense like the lighthouse. Isolde pushed the mare into a canter. She needed to be at the perfect speed to fall in with Safi.
Move! Safi's voice shrieked out. Get off the road, you idiot!
Isolde only looked back once to scream,
It's me, Safi!
Then she kicked the mare into a gallop, just as Safi hurtled into position beside her. They galloped side by side.
Sorry to make you wait,
Safi roared over the rapid 4-beat race. Her legs were bared, her silk gown shredded, and she clutched a pitchfork to her stomach.
And sorry for the trouble on my ass. Good thing I have a plan, then,
Isolde shouted back. She couldn't hear the pursuing monks, but she could sense their threads. Calm. Ready.
The lighthouse is close enough for us to make a stand. Is the tide out? Should be.
Safi's white threads flickered with icy blue relief. She shifted her gaze briefly to Isolde, then back to the road.
Where's your hair? She shouted. And what happened to your arm? Cut my hair and got shot with an arrow. God below, Isolde. A few hours away and your whole life tumbles through the hell gates. I might say the same to you,
Isolde shouted back, though it was getting hard to scream and ride.
4 opponents on your tail and a ruined dress.
Safi's threads flickered to an almost giddy pink and then flared with panicked orange.
Wait, there are only 4 Carowinds. Yeah? There should be a 5th.
Safi's threads glowed even more brilliantly.
And it's him, the Blood Witch.
Isolde swore, and a great downward sweep of cold knocked away her calm. If a soldier like Habim had failed to stop the Blood Witch, then she and Safi stood no chance. But at least the lighthouse was starting to take shape now, its stout walls separated from the road by a long strip of beach and receding tide. The horses pounded off the shore and into the waves, salt water blasted upward. The old tower with its barnacles and gull crap was 30 paces away. 20, 5.
Dismount!
Isolde screamed, pulling the reins with far more force than was fair. She scrabbled off the horse, and with hands that were almost shaking, she unstrapped the cutlass. Beside her, Safi splashed into the ankle-deep waves with her pitchfork gripped tight. Then, without another word, the girls settled into defensive stances, their backs to the tower, and waited for the 4 monks to gallop across the beach toward them.
14. The Janna slipped through coastal waters with barely a peep from her usually groaning wood. Merrick stood at the weather-worn tiller, gripping it tight and steering the warship, while beside him on the quarter-deck were Cullen and 3 Tide Witch officers. As one, Cullen and the officers chanted below their breaths, their eyes wide behind wind spectacles. The lenses protected them from the bewitched air, while the sea shanty on their tongues kept them focused. Normally, Ryber would pound the wind drum, with the unbewitched mallet, to give the men a beat to sing by. And normally the entire crew would bellow a shanty. But tonight, quiet and stealth were required. So the 4 men sang alone while the wind and tides they summoned hauled the ship onward. The remainder of Merrick's crew sat across the main deck. Nothing to do when magic did all the work for them. Merrick glanced at Cullen every few moments. Though he knew his thread brother hated it, yet Merrick hated seeing Cullen's lungs seize up and his mouth bob like a fish. And the attacks always seemed to happen when Cullen summoned more magic than he ought. Right now, the way the Janna skimmed across the sea's surface, Merrick had no doubt Cullen was calling on heaps of power. Merrick and his man had left the Doge's palace earlier than planned. After the disastrous New Brevenan four-step, Merrick had wanted to be anywhere but the party. His magic had been out of control, his temper exploding in his veins, and it was all because of that stormy-eyed Kartorin. Not that he would ever admit that, of course. Instead, he'd blamed the early departure on his new job for Dom Aaron von Hastrel. That man had arrived at the perfect moment, and the conversation that had followed had been more fruitful than Merrick could have dared hope. Dom Aaron was a soldier. Everything in his bearing and gruff voice had indicated that, and Merrick had instantly liked him. What Aaron was not was a keen businessman. And for all that Merrick might have warmed to the man, he was hardly going to point out that Dom Aaron's proposal was heavily in Merrick's favor. All Merrick had to do was carry a single passenger, Dom Aaron's niece or daughter or something like that, to an abandoned port city at the westernmost tip of the Hundred Isles. As long as the woman reached Lejna unharmed, he'd been especially emphatic about the unharmed part, then the bewitched document now sitting on Merrick's table would be considered fulfilled. Negotiations for trade could begin with the Hastrel farmers. It was a miracle. Trade would change everything for his nation. From how many people died of starvation to how negotiations at the truce summit went. Merrick didn't even mind that he would have to sail right back to Venyatsa City after dropping this Hastrel girl off on the Lejna Pier. What were tide and wind witches for, if not crossing the Jadansi in days? So Merrick had signed the contract alongside Dom Aaron. And then the instant the man was gone, Merrick had summoned Herman back to his cabin. "Inform Vivia that the piracy endeavor is no more. And also mentioned that the Dalmoti trade ship is only just leaving the Venyatsin harbor. Just in case she decides she won't back down." As Merrick had anticipated, Vivia wasn't ready to give up her scheme. But that was fine. Merrick could continue to lie. Soon enough, he would have trade with someone. And that was all that mattered.
"Admiral!"
Ryber's high-pitched voice cut through Merrick's thoughts. Cullen and the other witches flinched, and Merrick swore. He had ordered silence, and his crew knew how he punished disobedience.
"Don't stop,"
Merrick muttered to Cullen. And with his fingers fidgeting with his shirt tails, he marched around the steering wheel and off the quarter deck. Wide-eyed sailors gawked as he stomped past. Several men ogled up at the crow's nest, where Ryber was waving her arms frantically, as if Merrick didn't know exactly where the ship's girl was stationed. Oh, Merrick would most certainly put Ryber in the leg irons tomorrow. He didn't care if she and Cullen were heartthreads, so long as Ryber remained a reliable sailor. This, however, was direct disobedience. And it would earn her 6 hours strapped in the irons with no water, food, or shade.
"Admiral!"
A new voice rattled over the deck. It was a salt-wasted sound. Herman.
"Admiral!"
he bellowed again. And Merrick almost lost control of his own voice. Two of his best sailors breaking the rules? 10 hours in the leg irons. For each of them. Ryber's bare feet hit the deck.
"There's a battle going on, sir, at an old lighthouse nearby."
Merrick didn't care about old lighthouses. Whatever battle Ryber had seen was not his problem.
"Sir,"
Herman huffed as he hobbled toward Merrick. The voice which his lame foot could barely keep up with his good one, yet he pushed himself as fast as he could.
"Sir. We got a message from Aaron von Hastrel's voice, witch."
He gulped in air.
"Our passenger is on the run. Last seen on horseback north of the city and aiming for an old lighthouse. The Hastros men can't get to the dome now in time. So it's up to us.
Carowin monks? Ryber asked Herman. Then she turned back to Merrick.
Because that's what I saw through the spyglass, Admiral. Two people standing off against four monks.
Aye, it's the Carowinds,
Herman admitted with a nod.
And if we don't get this passenger away, then whatever binding agreement you've got is considered null.
For half a breath, Merrick merely stared at Herman, at Ryber. Then the Nihar rage got the best of him. He tipped back his head and gave a fist-clenching roar. It would seem the old lighthouse battle was his problem, and there was absolutely no reason for stealth now. He needed this Hastral document untainted. It was word-witched. So if Merrick didn't meet the contracted requirements, his signature would simply vanish from the page. An unsigned trade agreement was useless. Bellowing for his oarsmen to get in position, Merrick spun on his heel and strode back toward his officers and first mate. They hadn't paused their concentrated magic, though they had changed course. The Janna now sailed west, toward shore, toward the lighthouse.
Stop!
Merrick ordered. Four mouths broke off mid-shanty. The wind gusted down and vanished. The Janna drifted onward, but her pace slowed instantly. Merrick eyed Cullen. Sweat shone above the first mate's lip, but he showed no signs of exhaustion.
I'm going ashore, Merrick said. The ship falls under your command. I want you to bring the Janna as close to the lighthouse as the depths will allow.
Cullen bowed his head, fist over heart.
Have Ryber keep her eye to the spyglass,
Merrick went on.
Once I get the passenger away from these monks, I'll give the wind flourish. Then I want you to carry the passenger here. As soon as her feet hit the deck, you'll order the oarsmen and the tide witches to make sail.
Merrick didn't wait for confirmation before marching to the bulwark. Behind him, the tide witches and Cullen resumed the sea shanty. The wind and currents picked up once more. Merrick leaned against the waist-high railing, chest puffing full. Then came a sharp exhale and a second lung-expanding inhale. Air spiraled around his legs, and his magic focused inward. The airstreams picked up speed and power. Merrick took off. His eyes teared up. Salty wind was forced into his nose and down his throat. His heart soared straight into his skull. For that brief second when all of his wind witchery was focused into a single funnel below him, when he shot through the air as easily as a petrel on a wave, he was invincible, a creature of joy and strength and power. And then his height would plummet. He would drop low to the water and conserve his energy by feeding off the natural skip of air, for his powers were limited and his magic quickly tapped. He couldn't maintain flight for long. The lighthouse zoomed closer. Closer. The water turned shallow. The waves white-tipped. Then he was close enough to the tower to see two girls burst around the side. They hopped up steps Merrick hadn't seen were there. One was a girl in black with a short blade, and the other was a girl in silvery white. A girl Merrick recognized instantly, even from this distance, even with half her gown slashed off. He had just enough time to curse Noden, and his coral throne, too, before all his attention went into slowing his descent and crushing any blighted monk who dared get near his passenger.
15.
As Lady Fate would have it, Edwin was the only Carowin who couldn't find a horse. His magic had led him and the other Carowins to the outskirts of Vinyatsa City. Then, at a cluster of inns, the Truth Witch had ridden into the street ahead. With a simple point of Edwin's finger, the four monks moved into formation and the real pursuit had begun. Or it had for the other Carowinds, who'd easily found borrowed steeds at the first two inns. By the time Edwin finally found a piebald mare outside a tavern, he was at least 5 minutes behind the others. Fortunately, Edwin was a good rider, and the piebald trusted him. Horses always did. Soon enough, he was galloping down the long coastal highway, the arrows in his chest bouncing uncomfortably. They were barbed, and if he removed them, he would only shred his flesh further, and then his body would automatically heal. A waste of energy better used in this chase. Edwin caught up to a cart, barreling north at wheel-shattering speed. It smelled faintly of the Truth Witch, and Edwin glimpsed a blanket beneath sunflower stalks. A satisfied smirk pulled at his lips. It was a blanket made of salamander fiber, and if the girl had only remained beneath the blanket, Edwin might never have caught her scent again. Her mistake. Soon, Edwin was past the cart and the panicked driver, and it was only he and the piebald for several minutes of maximum exhilarating speed. Then a tower appeared, a dark blotch against a night sky. Edwin would have missed it were it not for the four white figures beside the stone ruins, or the riderless horses galloping toward him. Just as Edwin aimed into the waves, his mare decided the other horses had the right idea. Edwin gave up on her. With a splash, his boots hit the water and he kicked into a jog. Yet he only made it halfway to the tower before the four Carowinds wheeled around it and out of sight. Moments later, a figure plummeted from the sky. Wind Witch. Edwin rounded the tower, and a gale slammed into him. He barely managed to grab hold of the lighthouse stones before two monks hurled past in a tornado of air and water. 20 paces. 50. They crashed limply to the beach, and they probably wouldn't rise for a long while. As the wind died down, swirling over the shallow waves, Edwin clawed himself back to his feet and sprinted onward to a set of steps. The Truth Witch's scent had ascended, so Edwin would as well. But he'd only circled one set of barnacle-laden stairs when two monks staggered into his path. Edwin grabbed at the first man's cloak. "What is it?" The monk jolted, as if woken from a daze.
"Carowin," he rasped. "I saw them. We must stand down."
"What?" Edwin reared back. "That's impossible."
"Carowin,"
the monk insisted. Then, in a bellow that blasted over Edwin, over the sounds of winds and waves,
"Stand down, men!"
The monk wrenched his cloak from Edwin's grasp and pushed down the remaining steps. Edwin watched in horror as the second monk followed.
"Fools!" Edwin growled. "Fools!"
He leaped up the last few steps, reached the top floor, and skittered to a stop. The Nomatsi girl was there, dressed in black and sunk low in her stance. She held a cutlass, arced up in a stream of silver steel, while her black threadwitch gown swept in the same direction. And beside her, standing tall, was the white-gowned Safiya with a pitchfork swooping in a blur of dark iron, her white-shorn skirt swinging downward. It was the circle of perfect motion. Of the light-bringer and dark-giver, the world's starter and shadow-ender, of initiation and completion. It was the symbol of the Carowin. Carowin. In that tenth of a frozen heartbeat, as all the images clamored for space in Edwin's brain, he allowed himself to wonder if it was possible. If these two girls of moonlight and sunshine could be the mythical pair that his monastery had once protected. But then the girls moved apart, and a wind witch appeared behind them, The man, wearing a Nubrevnin naval uniform, was hunched over as if too exhausted to fight. His face was hidden in shadows, his fingers flexed, and wind gathered slowly toward him. Edwin cursed himself. Of course these girls would look like the Kar Awen with air currents spiraling around them.
"Stay back," the Truth Witch shouted. "Don't move."
"Or what?"
Edwin muttered. He lifted his foot to move forward, but the Nomatsi girl actually answered.
"Or we will decapitate you, Blood Witch."
"Good luck with that."
He stepped forward, and Safiya darted at him, pitchfork out.
"Get away from us!"
Her voice ripped off as Edwin took control of her blood. It was his secret weapon, a blood manipulation he only used in the most dire of situations. He had to isolate the components of Safiya's blood, the mountain ranges and the dandelions, the cliff sides and the snowdrifts. And then he had to pin them down. It was exhausting work, and took even more energy and focus than the high-intensity sprint. Edwin couldn't maintain this control for long. Safiya's body was stiff, her pitchfork extended like a glaive. She looked trapped in time. Not even her eyes moved. In a rush of speed, Edwin darted towards Safiya. Yet just as he reached her, just as he crouched down to heave her onto his shoulders, the Wind Witch burst into action. The man's arms flung upward, and both he and Safiya rocketed off the tower in a roar of wind. It kicked Edwin backward, propelled him toward the tower's edge. Edwin lost control of Safiya's blood. He launched into a sprint. Safiya was 10 feet high now and flying backward, her body a frantic span of limbs and skirts. She was screaming over the wind,
"Hizult! Hizult!"
If Edwin ran, he could leap into the Wind Witch's air funnel. A body hurled into him. He toppled sideways, barely transferring into a roll before the Nomatsi girl thrashed him to the ground. Yet Edwin was already spinning, fingers clawing for any wrists or elbows he could break, his blood witchery grabbing for any blood to lock down. But just as Edwin's fingers caught empty air, his blood witchery found nothing. The girl was already flipping off him, already charging toward the edge of the tower. She would jump. Edwin knew she would jump. So he leaped to his feet, too, and bolted after the girl named Isolt. She hit the edge of the lighthouse. She jumped. Edwin hit the edge, too. He jumped. And they fell. Together. So close, Edwin could grab her if he wanted to. But it was like she knew it. Like she'd planned it that way. Midair in a fall that would last barely a second, she swiveled around. Her legs writhed through his and flipped their bodies. His back hit the sand. So hard the world went black. Distantly, he felt the girl crash against him. Arrowheads dug even deeper. They smashed his ribs, his lungs. There was pain everywhere. His organs. They were all destroyed. And he was pretty certain his spine was broken, too. That was a first. Then waves washed over his skin. A breath passed. Edwin thought he might make it out alive, until he felt a black explosion in his chest. It cleared through all the other pains, and his eyes snapped wide. The hilt of his stiletto poked from his heart. His cloak and tunic were too stained to show the blood flowing out. But he knew it was there. Pulsing faster than his power could keep up with. Yet he couldn't withdraw the knife. He couldn't do anything because he couldn't move. His spine was definitely broken. Edwin lifted his gaze, the world streaming and blurry, and then morphing into a face. a face of shadows and moonlight only a foot away from his. The girl's lips shuddered with each gasping breath. Her hair flew on the breeze. A natural breeze, Edwin realized. And her thighs trembled against his broken ribs. He saw no one else, heard no one else. For all he knew, they were the only people left alive in this battle. In the entire world. Then his gaze fell on a pain stone hanging from her neck. Its rosy glow was fading, almost gone, and he could see from the strain on her face that she was hurt. Badly. Yet she still managed to unstrap a cleaving knife from Edwin's baldric. She still managed to drag it to his neck and hold it there. The blade trembled against his skin. She had stabbed him in the heart with his stiletto, and now she was going to decapitate him. But the cleaver stopped. The girl called Isolde cringed, and her painstone flared a soft pink before winking out completely. A groan erupted from her lips. She almost toppled forward, and Edwin glimpsed the wound on her right bicep. Blood-stained linens. Blood he should be able to smell.
"You have no scent,"
he ground out. He could feel his own hot blood gushing over his teeth, dribbling from the sides of his mouth.
"I can't smell your blood."
She didn't answer. All of her concentration was on holding the cleaver steady.
"Why can't I smell you? Tell me."
Edwin wasn't sure why he wanted to know. If she cut off his head, he would die. It was the only wound from which a blood witch couldn't recover. Yet still, he couldn't seem to stop asking.
"Why?"
Blood sprayed with that word, splattered the flat steel of the cleaver. A fleck hit her cheek.
"Why can't I?"
She eased the blade away from his throat, not gently. It cut through skin and dragged onward, as if she was too tired to even lift it. Edwin's impaled heart fluttered. It was a strange feeling of relief and confusion that lifted with the blood in his mouth. She wasn't going to kill him. He had no idea why.
"Do it,"
he rasped.
"No."
She shook her head, a jerky movement. Then wind, of the charged, unnatural variety, gusted over them. It sprayed her hair from her face, and Edwin forced himself to note every detail. He might not have been able to smell her blood, but he would remember her. He would remember her round jaw that didn't quite fit with her pointed chin. He would remember her snub nose and pale freckles, her angled, cat-like eyes, her short lashes, and her narrow mouth.
"I will hunt you," he croaked.
"I know."
The girl dropped the cleaver on the sand and used Edwin's chest to push herself upright. His ribs crunched, and his stomach squished. She was not light, and his organs were pulp.
"I will kill you," he went on.
"No."
The girl's eyes thinned. She pushed herself further upright and the moon streamed over her. She coughed, then wiped her mouth.
"I don't think you will."
It seemed to take all her concentration to get those words out. And it was with an edge of frustration that her fingers laced around the stiletto once more. She shoved the blade deeper into Edwin's heart. Against his most desperate, frantic desire, against every instinct that screamed at him to stay alert. His eyelids fell shut for half an agonizing breath. A moan slipped over his tongue. In that moment, the weight on his body vanished. Footsteps slapped through the water away from him. When his eyes finally opened again, he saw no sign of the girl. Not that he could have turned his head to look. Then a wave washed over him, and Edwin sank beneath the sea foam.
16.
The wind roared in Safi's ears as she flew. Her eyes streamed, her skirts tossed, and she quickly gave up shouting at Prince Merrick to go back. He couldn't hear her. The ocean blurred beneath Safi, lucent and trembling, and Safi thought vaguely that she should enjoy this. She was flying, after all. But she didn't enjoy it. All she cared about was Isolde, left behind, with the Blood Witch. In the back of her mind, other urgent thoughts snarled, like why Prince Merrick was stealing Safi from the lighthouse, how he'd gotten there at such a perfect time. Then Safi was hurtling much too fast toward a sharp-bowed New Brevenan warship, and that engulfed all her other concerns. Oars spun. Sailors in blue scurried about, and a booming drumbeat hit Safi's ears. Right as she thought she would crash onto the main deck and break all her bones, her pace slackened. She drifted gently down. In two breaths, Safi had her balance and was on her feet. One more breath and she had a lock on Prince Merrick. He was almost to the quarter-deck by the time she grabbed his shirt and ripped him about. "Take me back!" He didn't resist, but rather pointed toward shore. "My first mate has your friend." Safi followed his finger. Sure enough, she found the tall blonde man with his attention on a figure flying this way. "Isolde?" But Safi's thread sister was limp. As Safi bolted for the first mate, she roared for a healer or surgeon or someone to help. The first mate eased Isolde onto the quarterdeck with his magic, and Safi was instantly beside her. She tugged Isolde's head onto her lap and pressed fingers to her throat, praying for a pulse. "Yes, yes, faint but there." Although in the glaring moonlight, there was no missing the growing smear of red on Isolde's arm or the dead painstone around her neck. Movement flickered in the corners of Safi's vision. The prince, the first mate, other sailors closing in. Then came a flash of white and a woman's voice. "Get my kit!" Safi yanked around to find a Carowin monk striding toward her from the ladder below decks. "Get away from that girl," the woman ordered. But Safi didn't move. After being hunted by Carowins, she wasn't about to let another one get close. If those four monks had been working with the Blood Witch, then this one probably was too. The woman had silver-white hair, yet the way the moon glided over her skin, she couldn't have been any older than Matthew or Habim, and she was freeing her blade with the poise of an equally skilled swordswoman. "Step back, girl."
"So you can finish what the other monks started. No, thank you."
In a rush of movement, Safi yanked a cutlass from the first mate's scabbard and spiraled at the Carowin monk, who deftly ducked beneath Safi's next attack, and then slapped the flat of her blade against Safi's knee.
"Someone stop her!"
the monk yelled. And just like that, Safi's air choked off. She tried to billow her lungs, to clench her stomach, to do anything that would draw in breath, but there was nothing. With an easy swat, the monk knocked away Safi's blade. The cutlass clattered across the wood, and Safi clutched at her throat. Stars blinked across her vision. The first mate was a full-blown air witch, and he was collapsing Safi's lungs. It was at that moment, as Safi's knees buckled and the world swirled into darkness, that Merrick stepped over her, his expression hard but not cruel. "Evrain means your friend no harm. She's a healer monk, Domna, a water witch healer." Safi clutched at her throat, unable to speak, to breathe. "If you promise to behave," he continued, "then Cullen will return your heir. Can you promise that?" Safi nodded desperately, but she was too late. Her body was too starved of breath, and darkness overtook her.
Safi awoke with her tongue fat and sticky. Footsteps thumped above, water sloshed against creaking wood, and the smell of salt and tar was thick in her nostrils. For several moments, all she could make out was a dark room with a weak beam of sunlight filtering through a window at her left. Then the room oriented, and Safi saw Isolde sprawled across a single, bolted-down pallet in the opposite corner. Isolde's eyes were closed, her breath rasping.
Safi lurched to her feet, stumbling off a second pallet and almost sprawling flat from the blood roaring across her vision.
Isolde!
She dropped to the floor beside her thread sister. Sweat dripped down Isolde's face, her skin even more ashen than usual. And when Safi pressed a gentle hand to Isolde's brow, the skin was boiling. Only once had Safi seen Isolde this badly hurt, after she'd broken her shin bone. But this injury was worse. There was no Matthew or Habim to help them now. Safi and Isolde were alone. Completely alone on a foreign ship with no one on their side. And with none of it making any sense. Isolde had mentioned getting shot, but the how, the where, the why? Safi had absolutely no idea. The iron latch on the door spun up. Safi stilled. The whole world stilled. Then the white-robed monk slipped in. Slowly, as if facing a wild animal, she flipped her hand in Safi's direction. The sun-browned skin was marked with an upside-down triangle for water witchery, and a circle for her specialization with the fluids of the body. Safi fixed her gaze and her magic on the woman, and the longer she stared, the more she saw the healer's heart was true. Nonetheless, Safi couldn't bring herself to fully trust. What had the prince called her? Evrain. Safi had been tricked too often lately. For now, she would watch the monk work and use the moment to gain any information she could. Safi rolled to her feet and backed away from Isolde, hands up submissively.
I won't interfere. Just make sure you heal her.
She'll do the best she can, said a new voice.
Merrick appeared in the doorway as the monk crossed lightly to Isolde. Safi smiled at the prince, a bored, unthreatening flash of teeth.
I was wondering when you'd come along, prince. Care to tell me where we are?
The Western Jadansi. You've been on board for 4 hours.
He stepped warily to the center of the room, as if he wasn't stupid enough to trust Safi's demeanor. He wore a simple navy frock coat over a fresh shirt and breeches, and Safi was suddenly struck by her own filth. Her gown was shredded and stained, and far too much of her dirt-streaked calves and thighs were exposed. Then, faster and more quietly than Safi could have ever expected, Merrick shot in close, hooked Safi's arms behind her back, and pressed something cool against her throat. The smell of sandalwood and lemons pierced her nose. Safi didn't cower back, though. She simply cocked her head sideways and drawled,
You do realize your blade is still sheathed.
And you do realize that I can still kill you with it.
Merrick's breath tickled against her ear.
Now tell me, Domna, are you wanted by the authorities? Any authorities of any nation?
Her eyes narrowed. Merrick had been at the ball. He had heard the betrothal announcement. Or had he? Safi hadn't seen him in the crowd, so perhaps he'd abandoned the ball before Henrik's declaration. Safi prodded her magic for some indication of Merrick's true nature. Power instantly charged through her, both clawing and warm. A contradiction of falsehoods and truth. As if Merrick might return Safi to Emperor Henrik if he were given the chance, or he might not. Safi couldn't risk it. Yet before she could speak, Merrick pressed the dagger harder into her flesh. I have a crew to protect as well as an entire nation. Your life is nothing compared to that. So do not lie to me. Are you wanted?
Safi hesitated, considering if she was endangering Merrick's fleet. Uncle Aaron had staged her flight to look like a kidnapping. That much Matthew had told her.
Yet as far as she could tell, there was no way that Emperor Henrik could find out where Safi had been taken.
So she tipped up her chin, exposing her throat all the more.
Your strategy is a poor one, Prince. But if there are people following me, I have no incentive to tell you.
Then I guess I'll kill you.
Do it, she taunted. Slit my throat with your steel-sheathed dagger. I'd love to see how you manage that.
Merrick's expression didn't waver, nor did the dagger.
First tell me why the Carowinds were after you.
The monk's shoulders stiffened, drawing Safi's eyes to her white cloaked back.
I have no idea, but you could ask that Carowind over there. She seems to know.
She doesn't.
Merrick's voice was sharp with impatience.
And you would do well to address her properly. She is Monk Evrain, sister to King Seraphin of Nubrevna.
Now there was some useful information.
So if Monk Evrain is the king's sister, Safi mused, and the king is your father, why, Monk Evrain must be your aunt. How nice.
I'm surprised, Merrick said. It took you so long to figure this out. Even a domna of Kartora should be well educated.
I never cared much for my studies, she volleyed back, and Merrick snorted.
It was a laughing snort that seemed to catch him by surprise, and seemed to annoy him, too, for he abruptly schooled his face and withdrew the sheathed blade.
Safi cracked her jaw, stretched her shoulders. Now that was a fun standoff. Shall we do it again tomorrow?
Merrick ignored her, and with a free hand, he yanked a cloth from his coat and wiped down his engraved scabbard.
On this ship, my word is law, Domna. Do you understand? Your title means nothing here.
Safi nodded and fought the overwhelming urge to roll her eyes.
But I am willing to offer you a deal. I won't lock you in chains if you promise to stop behaving like a feral dog and instead behave like the Domna you're supposed to be.
But, Prince?
She lowered her eyelids in an indolent blink.
My title means nothing here.
I will take that as a no, then.
Merrick turned as if to leave.
Deal, Safi spat, seeing it was time to fold. We have a deal, Prince. But just so you know, it's a cat.
The prince frowned.
What's a cat?
If I'm going to be anything feral, it'll be a cat.
Safi bared her teeth.
A mountain lion of the Nubrevnan fish-eating variety.
Merrick tapped his chin. I can't say I've ever heard of such a beast.
Then I suppose I am the first?
Safi waved dismissively at him before dropping back to Izzult's side. But Evrain lifted a halting hand.
You are too dirty to be here, Domna.
Her voice was husky, yet not unkind.
If you really want to help your friend, then you will get cleaned. Merrick, will you see that she is taken care of?
She glanced at her nephew, who was already aiming for the doorway.
It's Admiral Nihar, the prince corrected. At least while we're at sea, Aunt Evrain.
Is that so?
The monk asked calmly.
In that case, it is Monk Evrain. At least while we are at sea.
Safi had just enough time to see Merrick's expression turn sour before the prince was out the door, and Safi was scrambling after him. Climbing the ladder topside proved harder than Safi anticipated.
What with her body sore and the relentless onslaught of an early morning sun. Hissing and rubbing her eyes, she stumbled across the stone-scoured deck. Her legs were numb from disuse, and as soon as she got a solid grip on the wood, the ship would groan and heave the other way. The prince walked just ahead, deep in conversation with his first mate, Cullen. So Sophie angled a hand over her eyes.
Learn your terrain.
There was little to see beyond rolling waves. Only the eastern horizon had a craggy spit of land separating the sea from a cloudless sky. Sophie scooted around sailors. They scrubbed the wood, scurried up the riggings, heaved and towed, all to the hoarse bellows of a limping older man. Though some stopped to salute their prince, not all of them paused. One man in particular caught Sophie's attention, her witchery curdling at the sight of him, as if to say he was untrustworthy, corrupt.
Matsy loving smut,
the man snarled as Sophie passed. She grinned at him in return, making absolutely certain to memorize his square-jawed face. Soon she had stumbled to the ship's stern. She counted 30 paces, and stepped into the welcome shadow of the quarter-deck. Merrick opened a door, murmuring something to Cullen. Then the first mate saluted and marched back the way he'd come, his voice rising with surprising ferocity.
"Did I say you could take a cork, Leary? No naps until you're dead."
With her ears ringing from Cullen's roar and her vision blanketed by the loss of sunlight, Sophie paused at the doorway until the room took shape. It was an elegant cabin, and not at all the sort of space she would have imagined for a rugged man like Merrick. In fact, he seemed rigid and uncomfortable as he waited beside an intricately carved table with high-backed chairs.
"Shut the door," he ordered.
Sophie did, but tensed her muscles. She might have danced and fought with this man, but that didn't mean she trusted him in a room alone.
"False," countered her power, a sense of calm winding through her chest. "Merrick is safe."
Sophie relaxed, but only slightly. Perhaps he meant her no physical harm, but she still didn't know if he was ally or opponent. Merrick pointed vaguely to the back of the room.
"There is water for cleaning and a uniform for you."
Sophie followed his finger to a collection of shiny swords on the back wall. Beneath the swords sat a small barrel and some white towels upon a low bed. She didn't care about the water or the towels. It was the swords she found intriguing. They were strapped down, yet clearly easy to snap free. Though only if she found she needed one, of course. Merrick seemed to misinterpret Sophie's stare, for his expression softened.
"My aunt is a good healer. She will help your thread sister."
"True. What about you, though, Prince? Will you kill Isolde for being Nomadzi?"
Merrick's lips bounced open, with shock, with revulsion.
"If I hated Nomadzi's Domna, then I would have killed her on sight."
"What of your men?" Sophie pressed. "Will they hurt Isolde?"
"They follow my orders," he answered.
But Sophie didn't like how her magic winced at that statement, as if it were not quite true. Her foot started tapping, her bare foot.
"Do I get new shoes?"
"I haven't found any that will fit you."
Merrick smoothed at his shirt, pulling cotton against the lines of his chest.
"For the time being, you will go barefoot. Will you survive?"
"Yes."
Habim had insisted Sophie toughen her feet against the elements.
"You never know in what condition you'll find yourself," he always said. "Shoes should be a luxury, not a requirement."
At least once a month he'd insisted that Sophie and Isolde go barefoot for a whole day, and both girls had enough calluses to walk across hot coals, or at least very hot sand. Merrick grunted, almost gratefully,
and gestured for Safi to join him at the table. She did, though she made sure to stay on the opposite side, within bolting distance for the swords,